طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. The U.S. financial support of the Israeli military is legendary. The magnitude of that support in light of the wealth of Israel is obscene and tragic for Palestine, which is the victim of this huge military, the fifth largest in the world. Add to that the fact that Israel is the largest per capita importer and exporter of military hardware on the planet. You have to ask why. Why does the U.S. send $3.8 billion of military aid a year to a major manufacturer and distributor of arms to the international community? Today, this issue is addressed by Palestinian author, lecturer, researcher, and journalist Susan Abalawa at the annual Edward Said Memorial Lecture, which she delivered recently at the Jerusalem Fund and Palestine Center in Washington, D.C. Susan Abalawa has for years been conducting her own research into the Israeli arms industry, making chilling discoveries which she will share with you in this slightly edited lecture. Here is Susan Abalawa.
Let me first start by acknowledging that I'm speaking from Lenape lands, the original nation in this region that was comprised of many tribes who spoke various languages and dialects and who were displaced or genocided off the map by Quakers in the 18th century. It is an honor to give the Jerusalem Fund's annual Edward Said Memorial Lecture. I think I might be the first person giving this lecture who didn't know Professor Said personally. I did meet him once, though briefly in 2000, but his impact on my life, like most of us, has been profound indeed. For one, as a young activist, I internalized his lament on the lack of Palestinian presence in English fiction. And it is one of the reasons that propelled me, then a scientist working as a researcher for a pharmaceutical company, to try my hand at literature. My only regret is that I didn't finish my first novel in time for him to read it. I'd like to believe that he would have championed my work because that's the kind of thing he did. He used his brilliance and his stature and his name to uplift Palestinian talent wherever he found it. My lecture today, however, is not about literature, though it does have to do with narrative and perception. For this talk, I put on my scientist and researcher hat. The spark for this research actually started about a decade ago. I saw a random statistic that showed Israel among the top exporters of arms in the world. And it piqued my curiosity because it was listed with countries that had exceedingly larger populations and larger GDPs. So I did some digging to find out what the rankings would be per capita or per GDP. But with the exception of one or two anecdotal articles, there was really nothing. And certainly there was nothing systematic. I did a limited set of calculations years ago and ended up including those as a small piece of a larger talk that I gave 4 years ago. But I remained curious and I continued to read and research. And when the invitation for this lecture came, I knew I wanted to focus entirely on Israel's global arms industry. but I ended up adding others because, as I learned, it is impossible to separate Israel's arms industry from their surveillance, their diamond and military or police training industries. So before I get into the data, let me just briefly touch on some of the methodology. There's an organization called SIPRI, it's the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, that collects data on arms transfers around the world. SIPRI uses a common unit called TIV, or the Trend Indicator Value, that reflects arms deals across different geographic areas, different currencies, time periods, etc. And so based on that TIV data from SIPRI, in order to obtain arms transfers per capita, I used population databases from the World Bank, matched those up per country per year, and then used simple arithmetic to calculate arms transfers per country per year, normalized to population size. The resulting database was huge, and with hundreds of thousands of data points. So I solicited the help of Ajit Narayanan to help me QA the work and also help me create some of the graphs that you're going to see. I also want to thank Andrew Feinstein for giving me a deeper insight into the arms industry. Andrew is the author of a most informative book on the topic called Shadow World, and he produced an eye-opening documentary by the same name, which I also recommend. Linda Hanna also helped me dig up some archives for this research. But first, it's really important to note that the data from SIPRI that I'm going to present are very limited and surely represent a gross underestimation of actual arms deals, especially with countries like Israel, which is notoriously secretive about their arms trades. Another major limitation of the SIPRI data is the fact that SIPRI only catalogs conventional weapons and components. It does not include small arms, trucks, ammunition, and most lightweight weapons and components. And importantly, they do not include illegal or banned weaponry, which we know Israel uses, especially against Gazans, including white phosphorus, the dime ammunition called dense inert metal explosives, and also bunker busting bombs, which they use against Palestinian homes. And the most relevant exclusion in the SIPRI databases are drones. None of the registries on their website, as far as I could tell, include drones, which is a major weapons niche for Israel. So just keep these data limitations in mind when you see what is known and recorded. So first, this is the original data that I mentioned that sparked my interest. So this shows basically the rankings over time of various countries. And you can see this is absolute exports. You can see Israel starts to climb in the 70s. And then from the 90s onward, it's totally in the top 15. Ranking among, you know, countries with, again, far bigger economies and bigger populations. But then look what happens when we look at these exports per capita. Again, you know, in the 60s, Israel wasn't a huge exporter, but by the late 60s, they start ranking in the top 10, and then they, you know, continue to move up. From around 2000 onward, you can see that they rarely leave the number one position. And if they do, it's either number two or number three. So basically, Israel is the greatest arms exporter in the world per capita. And if we look at specific years, like here, for example, like 2016, if you look at just the difference between the number one position and the second position, I mean, it's many times more per capita. And these years actually reflect the years when Israel launched major offensives against either Palestinians in Gaza, the West Bank, or their neighbors. And so what this means basically is that Israel, it's basically war is big business for Israel. It's a huge boost to their economy. You see the biggest jumps here. This is the 2014 attack on Gaza. And then the 2008-2009 attack on Gaza. And it just, you know, it goes on. Most of the major arms traders are either top exporters of weapons or top importers. For example, countries like Saudi Arabia and India are top importers, but they're not major exporters. And rarely are countries ranked as both top importers and top exporters. Some countries do make the cut for both, both categories, but only at certain times in history. So, for example, Libya between the years 78 and 82 was importing a lot of weapons and then exporting them to leftist guerrilla liberation movements throughout Africa and Asia. So they show up in the top rankings for both, but only in that short period. On the other hand, Israel has consistently been the top state importers throughout their history, even though their imports have waned over time and given way to 2020, Israel is way ahead of any other country in the world. So, and that is, if we look actually in terms of absolute numbers, there's only three countries that are top importers and exporters. And they are, as you can see, Israel, Germany, and China. And this is pretty extraordinary when you consider the difference in their population, 9 million versus 83 million in Germany and 1.3 billion in China. And likewise, that their GDP rankings are hugely, you know, different. Israel is a fraction, obviously, of both countries, but yet it's playing in the same league in terms of arms imports and exports. But then when we look at the per capita numbers, is Germany and China fall off, and there's two countries left, Israel and Norway. These are the only two countries in the world since 1960 to 2020 that have ranked as top importers and exporters. And a closer look at these, I'm going to bring up the Gapminder again. Mohammed, nod if this is showing. Yeah, okay, good. So basically what you see here on the y-axis are exports per capita, and then on the x-axis are imports per capita. And this is, so basically you can see here, you know, until the early 80s, Israel was a huge, this was actually the greatest importer per capita of weapons in the world. You see, they were mostly importing weapons. And then from the 70s, actually after the Yom Kippur War, they begin to export more weapons. And then a major shift happens here in 1982 when they attacked Lebanon. And then again here, you can see this is during the Sabra and Shatila massacres. And then, you know, everything sort of shifts leftward and goes up as they begin to export more and more weapons. And so you can see here, even though Norway and Israel are together in that category of the only two top ranking importers and exporters, when you look at them together, you can see that there is no comparison even. Israel is in a league of its own in both imports and exports over time. And again, these peaks, again, this is that 2006 major export. And, you know, if you look at different time points, you can see, here's the Gaza assault, you know, the Lebanon assault, and here's another Gaza assault. And the major imports, you can see, also represent earlier on when, before they became a major exporter, they were importing a lot. So again, there's just, you know, Israel is really in a league of its own. So finally, in this section, I want to look at military spending per capita. These data are from SIPRI. And what you can see here for the past 5 years, from 2015 to 2020, Israel spends the most money, has the greatest military expenditures than any per capita than any country in the world. I think this one here is United States, Singapore's, I can't remember what they are, but these are countries in the rest of the world. So the message that emerges from these publicly available data on arms transfers is that from the period of 1960 to 2020, Israel has been the biggest per capita hustler of weapons in the world. What's more is that so much of Israeli arms deals occur with countries where genocide and other war crimes have taken place or are taking place, and where arms embargoes have been imposed by the United Nations. Let's start with Serbia. In between 91 and 95, long after the UN embargo was declared, Israel trained Serbian forces and armed them. At the time, Serbian forces were erecting concentration camps and committing massacres against the Bosnian Muslims, which led to the murder of 250,000 people. The diary of Ratko Mladic, a war criminal who oversaw the Serbian genocide of Bosnians in Srebrenica, made it clear that Israel had armed and trained them. Itay Mak petitioned Israel's high court to declassify documents pertaining to the extent of Israel's role in the Bosnian genocide, but the court rejected the petition, arguing that making that information public would harm Israeli interests. In addition to subordinating the truth to political or economic expediency, Israel engaged in revisionist history, sending top Israeli Holocaust scholars to work hand in hand with Serbian government officials to reverse world consensus that genocide had actually taken place. So Israel supplied weapons and training to perpetrators of genocide while it was globally known that at least ethnic cleansing and or serious human rights abuses were taking place and during an explicit UN arms embargo. Then Israel's high court ensured their role would remain secret, and then they helped rewrite history in favor of those who committed crimes against humanity. In Rwanda, where an estimated 1 million men, women, and children were massacred, which is said to be the fastest pace of genocide in human history, with 10,000 people murdered each day for more than 3 months in 1994, Israel provided the rifles, ammunition, and grenades that made it all possible. Literally, an arms transfer was made 2 weeks into the bloodletting. Itay Mak said these weapons deals can be compared to a country arming Nazi Germany with full knowledge of their death camps and extermination goals. Itay Mak petitioned the Israeli High Court for declassification of Israel's role in that genocide. In his petition, he quoted one of the Israeli arms dealers who expressed pride in his work, saying, "I am actually a doctor," because he said the weapons he provided helped the victims die quickly. And like all other attempts to appeal to the court, Israel's highest judicial arm refused the petition, once again providing legal cover to war crimes. Also, as with the Bosnian War, Israel backed Rwanda's efforts to rewrite history to ignore the tens of thousands of Hutus who were also killed and displaced. And this was part of a quid pro quo agreement with Paul Kagame, so that Rwanda would take some of the African asylum seekers that Israel was trying to get rid of. In Myanmar, likewise, Israel sold arms to Myanmar's military junta, even as the world understood it was committing genocide against the Rohingya minority. Following the military coup earlier this year in Myanmar, Amnesty International issued a report suggesting that Israel was continuing to supply the military junta, at least with surveillance equipment. And again, Itay Mak petitioned Israel's high court to stop the arms sales to Myanmar, but his petition was rejected and a gag order was imposed on the full ruling. So again, Israel supplied arms to a country that was known to be committing genocidal ethnic cleansing, and at a time when a UN embargo, arms embargo was in place, and Israel's high court helped to enable it and cover it up. Likewise, they have meddled or fueled civil wars. South Sudan is an example. This civil war has left had left over half a million people dead and 4 million displaced in just a few years. And through it all, Israel continued to supply the South Sudanese regime with weapons, even after a worldwide UN arms embargo. Although Israel claimed to have halted weapon sales to South Sudan, a UN report documented otherwise, and they noted in the report that the Israeli weapons continued to pour into South Sudan, even after it was made clear that grave human rights violations were taking place, including the drafting of child soldiers, burning of villages, systematic rape, indiscriminate killing, pillaging, and destruction of infrastructure. This guy, Israel Zev, who is a retired Israeli general, was actually sanctioned by the U.S. Treasury Department after it was uncovered that he was using a fake agricultural charity to sell over $150 million worth of weapons to the South Sudanese. And activists led again by Itay Mack petitioned the high court to have the weapon sales disclosed to the public. But of course, the court once again rejected their petition. And in fact, a recent ruling by Israel's high court has made it, they basically shut the door on any future petitions. Just basically saying that's not their purview. And also in Syria, I'm just going to fly through these if you don't mind, but basically Israel all along was denying any involvement in the Syrian civil war. They claimed neutrality, but then, reports were leaking, activists uncovering and taking photos, and then they claimed to only be giving humanitarian aid. But thanks to the persistent work of activists and their documenting of Israeli weapons flowing in, Israel finally admitted that they had been arming al-Nusra all along, and al-Nusra is an affiliate of al-Qaeda. So they have taken part in fueling the bloodletting in Syria. Likewise, they did the same in Angola's civil war over about four decades, giving arms mostly to prop up the repressive white minority government, but they later switched sides when UNITA, the side that was backed by the CIA and the white South African government. Israel, of course, I think, I see Zionism as another face of white supremacy, and Israel has throughout its history propped up white colonial regimes, the most notable of which is South Africa. Israel was open in its support of apartheid South Africa, but it was secretive about the extent and the depth of the connection between the two nations. It was only after apartheid fell that the ANC declassified a lot of the documents, and we know what we know because of that. This is the cover of an explosive book when it was published in 2010 by Sasha Polakow-Saransky that detailed the never-before-known extent of cooperation between Israel and the apartheid government of South Africa. The coordination between the two nations was unprecedented. Their relationship was actually much deeper than mere trade, military, and intelligence coordination. Israel had a spiritual and moral affinity for apartheid South Africa, which was articulated in the 1980s by Chief of Staff Raphael Itan, who said, referring to indigenous Black South Africans, that they want to gain control over the white minority, just like the Arabs here want to gain control over us. And we too, like the white minority in South Africa, must act to prevent them from taking us over. In 1976, a mere 2 months after Israel rolled out the red carpet for the South African president, Voerster, school children in Soweto took to the streets to demonstrate against an imposed racist curriculum. The South African police mowed them down with guns and bullets that had been supplied by Israel. even after the Soweto massacre shocked the world and a UN arms embargo was placed on South Africa, Israel continued to arm and train them, share intelligence, and advocate for them. This is a New York Times article from 1982, 6 years after this iconic photo of Hector Peterson was taken during the Soweto massacre. Israel was trying to convince the world to send weapons to South Africa and complained that the UN embargo had created a shortage of spare parts for their friends. And what shocked the world even more was to finally learn that Israel had shared nuclear bomb technology with the apartheid government, a cooperation that went as far back as 1975. One more thing that's worth noting here, in 2007, the former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert warned that his country could one day face a South African-style struggle for equal voting rights. And as soon as that happens, the state of Israel is finished, he said. And I think this quote is interesting because it reveals how Israeli leaders view their state. And in this instance, Olmert clearly understands the apartheid nature of Israel. There's so many other, I'm going to just have to skip through these, honestly, for the sake of time. But Israel has been supplying arms to repressive colonial regimes, to dictators. They have supplied weapons to death squads, like in Guatemala and El Salvador and Honduras. Israel has also worked to collude. They've colluded with multinational corporations to basically facilitate the looting of African nations. And I put this example here of Equatorial Guinea, where they worked with ExxonMobil and the horrible Teodoro Obiang Nguema to basically siphon oil from that country while their people live in abject poverty. And there's a lot of other examples. Of course, they do the same thing with Chevron in Nigeria and other places. So Israel's arms exports that bolster repression and fighting have several goals, and the most important of which is profit, especially when it comes to entrenching the exploitive and bloody mining industries, especially diamonds. I felt it was important to have this section on diamonds because this industry has actually been the biggest part of Israel's economy since its inception. Besides the windfall of taking a whole country that was already built up with infrastructure and factories, buildings, banks, roads, and cultivated fields, in its early days, diamonds accounted for roughly 40% of exports. So basically, when Israel was first established, the country was, you know, almost bankrupt. They didn't have reserves of currencies, and so their only real exports were diamonds that they got from South Africa, and I'll get into that, and Jaffa oranges that they sold from Palestinians. So it's also the proportion of diamonds exports in their economy has given way to arms exports, but it remains a huge part of their economy. And I'll touch on that very briefly in a bit. But basically, it's impossible to separate the diamond industry from their armament industry. But first, historically, I want you to see what the diamond industry looks like. The term blood diamonds emerged because diamonds came to the market through the murder, maiming, and anguish of millions of Africans. The extraction and sale of diamonds was linked to the arming and financing of civil wars, internecine fighting, human trafficking, child labor, child soldiers, and systematic mutilations. So, while one pillar of Israel's wealth was built on the bodies and blood of Palestinians, The other pillar was built on the bodies and blood of Africans. So following years of organizing and awareness campaigns by activists and human rights organizers, companies and governments involved in the diamond trade created what's called the Kimberley Process in the year 2000. And the purpose of this was to offer some oversight over so-called conflict diamonds to prevent them from being sold. The Kimberley Process was basically a way for industry giants to end public campaigns against diamonds and to keep the money flowing by introducing measures for self-regulation. Although some improvements were made, as you can imagine, the Kimberley Process is deeply flawed and the abuses I mentioned remain rampant. But the activism of organizers succeeded in exposing this industry, which caused De Beers. De Beers is the behemoth diamond conglomerate that controlled over 90% of all world diamonds. It made them withdraw from some areas of Africa. De Beers, just taking a step back, is majority owned by the Oppenheimer family, which is a white South African family who built their empire on the backs of cheap black labor and who were responsible for shaping the apartheid structures and laws in South Africa. De Beers and the Oppenheimer family also contributed significantly to Israel throughout its short history. So after the Kimberley Process, seizing the opportunity to move in where De Beers was forced out, a network of Israelis established themselves in key conflict areas, and they made billions exchanging blood diamonds for weapons, military training, and money. The main poles of this network were Dan Gertler in the DRC, Lev Lviv in Angola, and Shmuel Schnitzer in Sierra Leone. The exchanged blood diamonds would be flown out of these countries by former Israeli Air Force pilots. And throughout this network were former Israeli generals, Mossad agents who handled the arming and training and intelligence gathering for militias and dictators. I want to take a quick look at these three, the harm they did in Africa, the billions they made, and how they turned around and used that money to fund oppression and of Palestinians and theft of our land and our resources. So Dan Gertler is the grandson of Moshe Schnitzer, who established Israel's diamond exchange in Palestine in 1947. He made billions by looting the Congo. He went there in the midst of the civil war in the 90s, and he got cozy with Laurent and Joseph Kabila. His purpose was to exploit ethnic division and instability to his advantage. Laurent Kabila, the father at the time, was facing an insurgency, and with the UN sanctions, he needed money. And Gertler used his political and military connections in Israel to get him the money he needed and the military wares and training that Kabila needed. First, he did that for the father, and then he did it for the son, Joseph. In exchange for weapons and a few million dollars, Gertler got exclusive rights to diamond and other precious mineral mining rights. He had no previous mining experience, but got some of Congo's richest copper, cobalt, and diamond assets. Global Witness, which is a human rights NGO, said, quote, "Dan Gertler is essentially looting Congo at the expense of its people." And Dan Gertler is also behind the financing of massive settlements in the West Bank, the destruction and theft of Palestinian property and Palestinian life that he financed is massive. And it is a continuation of the destruction and theft of the Congolese people, of their properties, their resources, and their labor. And though this is perhaps irrelevant to this talk, I was struck by the way that Gertler spoke of Kabila and other Black leaders who were ostensibly his friends. In a leaked transcript with one of his former Israeli partners, Gertler refers to them in a Hebrew word equivalent to the N-word, and he bragged about his talent for cutting deals with the Congolese by saying, quote, "Yossi, you don't get it. I understand the politics of the Negroes," unquote. Lev Lviv is an Israeli born in Uzbekistan. He made his fortune in Angola, exploiting the civil war to loot that country. Toward the end of the civil war, Like I said earlier, when UNITA, the side that was backed by South Africa and the CIA was losing, Israel switched sides and provided the government with intelligence and more. Lviv used his vast connections in Israel's military and political elites, including his chums Ariel Sharon, Netanyahu, and Avigdor Lieberman, to trade arms, training, and cash for rough diamonds in Angola. Together with corrupt Angolan generals, Lviv ran Angola's diamond mines like his own fiefdom, mimicking at times the enslavement and mutilations of King Leopold long before him, whose reign of terror in Congo was worse than anything Hitler did or dreamed of doing. Lviv has fallen from his perch since he became mired in a diamond smuggling scandal, and he was eventually also sanctioned by the U.S. Treasury Department for money laundering. And I should also mention that he had close ties with Jared Kushner and was heavily involved in building illegal Jewish-only settlements on Palestinian land. In fact, UNICEF cut ties with him over the matter of settlements in 2008. And then Shmuel Schnitzer is Dan Gertler's uncle and the former head of Israel's diamond exchange, who dealt in blood diamonds his entire professional life. The role of Israel and Israeli mercenaries, diamond and mineral tycoons, and the horrors perpetrated in Sierra Leone were brought to light in part due to the war crimes accusations and evidence and trial against Charles Taylor, who was the former president of Liberia, who during his rule turned Liberia into his own personal cash cow, with the help of diamond smugglers, illegal arms deals, corruption, bribery, military training, all of which Israel played a significant role. There are other Israelis in this network, like Benny Steinmetz in Guinea, who've done similar dirty dealings meant to extract African wealth while the people of these various resource-rich nations languish in abject poverty and lack of basic necessities. But what separates these Israeli criminals from their counterparts in other states is that these guys enjoy the secret backing of the state. Whether it's with access to arms and military wares, access to planes, the discretion of the state, the turning of a blind eye, at the highest levels, the political influence, and even as we see with Israel's high court, judicial cover for this. Now, I mentioned earlier, Israel's economy is heavily dependent on diamonds. It has given way to arms exports, so this is a snapshot of what Israel reported to the UN in terms of total exports in 2019, totaling $56 billion. You can see diamonds are roughly a fifth of their export economy. This is what they reported for military wares exports, and it's a bunch of crap because they only have 320 million here, which we know is not true, because even by their internal reporting, their defense ministry reported 7.3 billion in 2019. So if we use that number, we can see that arms exports accounted for roughly 13% of their total exports for that year. And if you combine that with the diamond exports, we can infer that 30 to 40% of Israel's export economy, and perhaps its overall economy, are predicated on the industries of arms and gems, both of which in turn are predicated on extraordinary human rights abuses, death, misery, oppression, and environmental degradation. I want to move briefly to touch on militarized police training, because that is directly relevant to citizens in the United States. In addition to arming some of the worst elements of humanity, Israel also provides countries and corporations with wares and training for domestic policing and suppression of dissent. In places like Brazil, Israel plays a huge role in their domestic surveillance, prisons, militarized borders, and internal policing and suppression. They are heavily involved in border surveillance, especially now, and patrol training along the U.S. and European borders to suppress refugees fleeing wars that they fueled in the first place. It's quite a racket. In the United States, there's widespread training of U.S. police departments. The export of Israel's brutal tactics to the United States has been so alarming that Jewish Voice for Peace launched a dedicated campaign called Deadly Exchange to fight against it. Hundreds of police and security agencies across the United States have gone on these training junkets to Israel, where they're both brainwashed about Israel and instructed in the ruthless military tactics. In 2016, Amnesty International published a report raising alarm about U.S. police forces being trained by one of the world's worst human rights violators. And they noted, as other human rights organizations have noted, as well as U.S. State Department, that examples of Israel's systematic and routine police and military abuses, like extrajudicial executions and other unlawful killings, routine harassments, torture, including against children, suppression of expression, of association, of movement, of night raids, systematic intimidation, the bolstering of paramilitary settler attacks, and more. And on these training junkets, Israel uses Palestinian neighborhoods to suppress, basically to stage live demonstrations of repressive violence in real time, whether in protests across the West Bank, in harassment in East Jerusalem, or shooting of Gazans along the border that Israel has imposed on them. So basically, like this Intercept title headline suggests, Israel has found a way to commodify 70 years of oppression and dispossession of indigenous Palestinians by marketing colonialism as model policing. And of course, surveillance. It is well known in the financial world and cyber espionage or cybersecurity world that Israel is the leading player. Even the most conservative estimates indicate that Israel produces and manages at least 20% of cyber surveillance around the world. And with less than 0.1% of the world's population, this makes Israel the highest exporter of surveillance per capita. There was a recent scandal involving an Israeli company called NSO, which ran a consortium of cyber espionage called Pegasus. It broke out on the world stage after documents were leaked, revealing over 50,000 names of politicians, human rights activists, journalists, and even heads of state who were being spied on by Israeli software. One of the people on that list was Emmanuel Macron, which infuriated France, and it's one of the reasons that the story blew up the way it did. And also what became obvious is that Pegasus played a key role in the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, the Washington reporter who was murdered and dismembered in the Saudi embassy in Turkey. Haaretz, the Israeli newspaper investigated the cybersecurity world, and they used over 100 sources, and they showed that Israel has knowingly been selling spying technology to some of the worst dictators and human rights abusers to monitor human rights activists, queer and trans communities, political dissidents, journalists, and more. So this here is just a sampling of some of the countries who purchased Israeli spyware and who were trained to use it to target specific groups. In Azerbaijan, for example, Verint systems were used to arrest gay men and transgender women. In Indonesia, the same system was used to create a database of LGBT rights activists. In the UAE, NSO spyware was used to hack the phones of human rights activists like Ahmed Mansour, who had published posts critical of the regime for which he is serving a 10-year sentence. I already mentioned Jamal Khashoggi in Saudi Arabia, but Saudi Arabia used Israeli surveillance to monitor other human rights activists like Omar Abdelaziz, a Saudi dissident who's living in Canada. Spyware systems were used by the repressive regime of Bahrain, especially during the Arab Spring, to track down human rights activists and political dissidents like Nabil Rajab, who's currently imprisoned for tweets. And then just as Israel's judicial system gives cover to the exports of military hardware used in genocide and oppression, they do the same thing for these cyber surveillance exports. The tireless Itaimak petitioned Israel's high court as early as 2016 to suspend NSO's export permit. However, at the request of the state, the deliberations were held in secret and a gag order was placed on the ruling. The Supreme Court Chief Justice summed up the reason for the gag and secrecy by saying, "Our economy, as it happens, rests not a little on that export." So basically, Israel's Supreme Court Chief Justice subordinated criminal activity to state and economic benefit. In other words, as far as their high court is concerned, money flowing to Israel is what matters most, not the truth, not accountability for human rights abuses, assassinations, massacres, etc. And of course, all of these wares, like their weapons, are tested on Palestinians, who are probably the most surveilled society in the whole world. I want to try, although the next two sections are complete, or, you know, the scope is beyond this talk, but I do think it's important to touch on how Israel has such a massive reach. And then after that, why is there so much silence around this? So for one thing, Israel is a highly militarized society. Everybody, almost everybody in Israeli society has to serve in the military. And many of them are just career military folks. So, but Israel also requires that they retire at a relatively early age. I think it's like 40-something, 45 maybe. So these folks who are still, you know, in the prime of their life, they know nothing but weapons and fighting and war. And so they become arms dealers. Israel has, they process like 40,000 arms export applications per year, I think. So there's a massive number of arms dealers coming out of Israel. And So there's that, you know, sort of militarized basis, but also Israel is a colonial society, and their citizens come from other countries. So they all have, most of them have dual citizenship, one, you know, in Israel and the other in their homeland, wherever that is. And so these folks have access to other countries. They have legal access by dual citizenship. They have linguistic access. They have cultural access. And many of them still have families there. So that also facilitates the, brokering arms deals and things like that. But really, the biggest attraction to Israeli weapons is the fact that they market them as being field tested. And that means that and that's the reason why we see these big booms every time after each time they attack Gaza, because that's where they test their new weapons. So basically, you know, Palestinian neighborhoods, especially in Gaza, are laboratories and live showrooms. And lastly, I'm just going to touch on the extraordinary silence. So I already explained how there's basically no transparency when it comes to Israeli arms exports. And the diamond industry functions more or less as a state within a state with very little to no oversight from the government. And I mentioned previously that there have been vigorous campaigns within Israel, mostly led by Itaimak, to force the declassification of arms sales. And it has been to no avail. So, and, you know, I also mentioned, I think, that the Israeli court has closed the doors even on trying to petition the courts. So there's no recourse to obtain information, and their highest court decidedly will not concern itself with Israel fueling genocide in other parts of the world. So in the department that handles exports within the Ministry of Defense is quite small, and decisions are made just by a handful of people. And sometimes it goes to the highest level, but this department is virtually unconstrained in how it functions. Now, so that's in Israel. On the other hand, in the West, and especially in the United States, there is this incredible and just kind of mind-blowing reluctancy to name Israel, no matter what. One example that came my way just a couple of weeks ago by my friend Rachel Holmes, the brilliant biographer of Eleanor Marx and Sylvia Pankhurst, among others, she sent me this article on cybersecurity and cyber warfare that was in Wired magazine. The article names several countries, the US, Russia, China, but Israel, which is the leading industry, it was the leading industry, is nowhere in the article. And like this might seem like a small thing, but it's actually a monumental omission, precisely because it's part of a much larger pattern in Western media that seems to shield Israel. And it's not just the media, of course. Washington is constantly giving political cover to Israel. I want to just give you this example that happened a few decades ago. It was during the Iran-Contra affair. And for those of you who aren't old enough to remember that scandal, very briefly, the Reagan administration went behind Congress's back in order to circumvent restrictions on giving aid to the Contras. The Contras were a militia that was trying to unseat the democratically elected government, the Sandinistas, in Nicaragua. So Congress had banned aid to the Contras, and so Reagan enlisted third parties to supply weapons as needed to them in exchange for U.S. favors. And Israel got a ton of favors. It was a windfall for them. And Israel was at the top of that list, and they played a central role in supplying weapons to the Contras. The FBI knew it. Everybody knew it. It was part of the state's memorandum of facts during the trial of Oliver North. Oliver North was a U.S. lieutenant colonel who was at the center of that scandal. That trial actually played out on television screens all over the country, much like the OJ trial. And but remarkably, when Congress issued its 700-page report on the investigation into the affair, there was hardly any mention of Israel. In fact, in the few sentences where it is mentioned, there's at least one attempt to try and absolve them and suggest that they wanted no part in the scheme. And the US media barely covered it. The Sunday Telegraph in the UK was one of the very few, if not only, media outlets to pick up on this. And they quoted a White House official who said, quote, "The American public never knew. It was a cover up." And we see this behavior to shield Israel from criticism at every level, whether it's the media, branches of government, academia, or otherwise. And there are some explanations for this, but it's beyond the scope of the talk, but I'm happy to recommend books to those who are interested. And this is this headline is an example. It's just the most recent one where an Israeli diplomat met with the president of University of North Carolina to pressure them to fire a faculty member who's critical of Israel. Now, this is actually quite common. And a lot of people have lost their jobs in academia for criticism of Israel. But again, there's a massive structure in the West to silence criticism of Israel and to punish people who don't remain silent. I'm way out of time, I think, so I'm going to stop there and just take questions.
Well, there you have Susan Abalawa's amazing analysis of the Israeli arms industry, which, of course, the U.S. supports with its dollars, many of which come back home to purchase arms from U.S. manufacturers such as Raytheon, Boeing, and others. Indeed, a very cozy arrangement. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. We'll talk again next week.